Well, as we've reported, the 2017 Utah legislative session is a wrap, and someone who sat through all 45 days, Brian Schott, managing editor at UtahPolicy.com. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So anything that stands out in particular for 2017 or just basically business as usual?
Well, it was a very, very quiet session, relatively. We didn't have any fights over Medicaid expansion, no fights over medical marijuana. A lot of that stuff was taken off the table early. There was, as you may remember, early on in the session, there were the efforts to send the resolutions asking for President Donald Trump to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument and reduce the size of Grand Staircase Escalante. That happened. But for the most part, it was a fairly quiet session. Lawmakers just hunkered down and got a lot of really significant stuff done without a lot of controversy.
Right. Budget, of course, is the main reason the legislature meets every year. What can you tell us about where our tax dollars are going for the coming year?
Well, this year's budget is set at $16.2 billion. That's up 7% from last year when it was at $15.1 billion. So the budget is growing. Education did very well. They got over half of all the new money that came in this year. They got a 4% boost in the weighted pupil unit. There was also fully funded all the growth in the schools. That means there's going to be 10,000 more students coming into the education system next year than will graduate this year. So that's about $68 million, the $70 million there to fund that. The 4% in the weighted pupil unit, it's about $30 million for every 1% you bump that. So that was another $120 million. And then on top of that, they funded teacher supplies. They got rid of the fees for teacher licensing. So education got about $220 million when it was all said and done in extra funding. Lawmakers also spent a lot, or they're set to spend a lot of money on transportation projects. They are going to bond for $1 billion in transportation projects. And this may be coming at a great time for lawmakers. The last time they did this in 2006, they bonded to rebuild the I-15 corridor through Utah County. That was over $1 billion as well. And that happened right before the recession. And a lot of economists think that Utah weathered the recession so well because we had these big construction projects going on and that kept our economy moving. So lawmakers over the next couple of years are going to be bonding for over $1 billion in transportation projects. UDOT has already picked which ones they want to fund, so that could be coming at a very good time right now. They're also bonded for almost $300 million in new buildings, a lot of those in higher education. The biggest one is $190 million for the medical school up at the University of Utah. They're also going to expand the stadium down in Dixie State and a few other projects there. So it's a big budget. There were a lot of big lifts this year, but they still got a lot of work ahead of them as they move into next year because they're going to be addressing income tax and sales tax reform over the next year.
Talk about that in just a second, but back to the whole idea of transportation, though. A lot of that has to do with what was approved, what, a year or so ago with the increase in the gas taxes, right? So we've been collecting a bunch of money from that.
Well, not necessarily. The gas tax is going to help pay for roads, but the $1 billion they're going to bond for is other transportation projects as well. What they did on the gas tax this year, 2 years ago when they passed an increase in the gas tax, they had a trigger point where if gas prices, rack prices or the wholesale prices, got to a certain point, that's when the new gas taxes would kick in or the higher gas taxes would kick in. When they set that, we were pushing $4, $5 a gallon at the pump. Now we're down to $2 a gallon at the pump, and it will be years before we get back to those original trigger points. So what lawmakers did is they dropped the trigger point. So now those gas taxes will go into effect to help pay for other transportation projects. But the $1 billion they bonded for, or they're going to be bonding for, is for a project on top of that. The gas tax will pay for maintenance, and then the $1 billion will pay for new construction. So there's going to be a lot of transportation work here in Utah over the next couple of years.
All right. And then the $220 million for education, that's still a far cry from the $750 million that Utah Schools Now Group would like to see every year. Are we going?
Oh, yeah. Lawmakers were never going to get near $750 million because they just didn't have it. The only way that they were going to be able to do that would be to raise taxes. They thought they were going to be able to find a way to provide more money for education by reinstating the state portion of the sales tax on food. But after they ran the numbers, they ran a number of economic models, and they contended for years that removing the sales tax on food, at least the state portion, made our sales tax collections more volatile. Well, it did, but not to the extent that they thought it would. So it wouldn't have had that much of an impact. So, yeah, you mentioned the Our Schools Now group. They're in the process right now of trying to figure out what they would like the ballot initiative language to say, and they're the group that wants to put on the 2018 ballot a proposed 0.7% increase in the personal income tax here in the state, which would raise about $750 million per year for Utah schools. The only way that you can get to that is by raising taxes, and that's not something lawmakers were going to do this year. But if you're talking with Governor Gary Herbert, he said if lawmakers can find a way to address all the exemptions and tax credits that we have in the tax code right now, find a way to reduce that so people aren't getting all those exemptions that reduce their taxes, and then they find a way to capture the sales tax on online purchases, which they estimate about $200 million a year will be is lost to that. They think that they can get close to that $700 million a year in extra money that Our Schools Now want. So it remains to be seen if they're going to be able to find that when they address this income tax reform over the next year. But they really don't want to have this ballot initiative go forward and then pass because they'll really tie their hands on what they're able to do budgetarily.
All right. We definitely saw some changes in Utah's liquor laws. You know, certainly nobody wants drunk drivers on the road, but dropping it the blood alcohol content down to 0.05, is that taking it too far?
Some people seem to think it's taking it too far. We did have the undersecretary for the U.S. Department of Traffic Safety or Transportation Safety come in, and she made some very interesting points. So she was on board with this change. She talked about truck drivers. Their level for driving while impaired is 0.04, and that's nationwide. And if they get caught driving 0.04, they lose their license forever. So it's a much stricter standard for truck drivers. There's a lot of places in Europe that have a 0.5 or lower standard. And what they really talked about is that this sort of goes hand in hand with the effort to get rid of the mandatory vehicle inspections that you have to do almost every year on your car to get relicensed. They killed that. And one of the stats they trotted out is they said about 90% of all traffic fatalities are a result of driver error, not car failure. Well, what causes driver error? Drunk driving can cause driver error. So, you know, lawmakers, it's a bold move, but I suspect that if Utah does this and it works, you're going to see other states follow suit as well.
Yeah. What about cell phones, though? I mean, because they're saying that cell phones, a University of Utah study, as you know, showed that cell phones account for, I mean, it's like driving while impaired.
Well, you're not supposed to use your cell phone behind the wheel anyway. They passed that law a few years ago, so you can get a ticket for using your cell phone behind the wheel. So you're not supposed to do that anyway.
Only
trying to find other ways to. Yeah, what? I'm sorry?
I was going to say it's just a secondary offense at this point, is my understanding.
Oh, yeah. It's obviously just a secondary offense, but you can get cited for that, and you're not supposed to do it. So it is an existing traffic law. There are arguments on both sides of the driving while impaired and the blood alcohol level. But, you know, Utah does not have a reputation as a state that has been friendly to alcohol laws. So anyone who's surprised that they took this measure, you're not paying attention.
Well, we even noticed that the Zion curtains are coming down. Certainly those, I guess, who have them are going to keep it up. It would be too expensive to take them down. But
some places will keep them up. Restaurants have three options now. They can either keep the Zion curtain if they want. They can install what some are calling the Zion Moat or the Zion DMC, which means if you are going to seat children anywhere near where alcohol is being prepared, there has to be a 10-foot buffer space. Or you can do what is called the Washington Wall, and this is what the state of Washington does. They want to keep children out of areas 6 feet from the bar. You have to have a barrier. It doesn't have to be a wall. It can be a railing. It can be something. But on the other side of that barrier, children are not allowed. Those are the three choices. Everybody has to be in compliance within 5 years on this. So you will probably see some places keep their Zion curtain up. Those will be places that don't have a lot of real estate. Other places may opt to put in the wall. Other places may opt to put in the Zion Moat. So, you know, the thinking behind that has not borne out in terms of actual results. Studies do not show that keeping children away from children seeing alcohol being prepared doesn't keep them from wanting to drink, because sometimes that booze just comes straight to their table where they're sitting anyway because their parents are drinking it. But, you know, it's just a measure that lawmakers feel like it's a measure the lawmakers could get passed. It was a compromise that they were able to make with all the restaurants that wanted to get rid of the Zion curtain. And frankly, it's what the LDS Church would agree to as well, because that's the elephant in the room when you're talking about alcohol policy in Utah, and the LDS Church has a vested interest in that alcohol policy.
You know, some tongue-in-cheek, of course, now asking, I mean, should we do the same with fast food restaurants, given that obesity kills some 300,000 people a year compared to the 88,000 that alcohol takes?
Well, but that's restricting commerce, and you'll hear that from lawmakers as well, that they don't want to become a nanny state. You know, and it's very inconsistent sometimes what they want to become a nanny state on and what they don't want to become a nanny state on. Alcohol, absolutely, they want to be a nanny state on that. Tobacco products, same thing. But, you know, other stuff, fast food, things like that, they probably won't do anything about.
All right. Anything else that's going to be looked at over the coming year? You mentioned medical marijuana off the top, just saying that that kind of died quickly. Is that going to be something? I thought we were doing some studies to bring it back this year.
Well, yeah, they did fund some studies. It's going to be some medical studies at the University of Utah in conjunction with USTAR, which is the Utah Science and Technology Research Initiative. And so they're going to be studying it. But is that going to lead to any legislation next year? No, it's not. I know that there are some groups out there that are going to plan to do a ballot initiative to try to legalize medical marijuana here in the state, a lot of libertarian groups. They're going to have to raise a lot of money. It takes about $1 million to get that on the ballot. Utahns would like to have the legalization of medical marijuana. So you'll hear a little bit about that, but medical marijuana has been taken off the table. The watchword for the next year is going to be tax reform. Lawmakers are going to look at ways to reform income tax. They're going to look at ways to reform the sales tax. But all they want to do, and you're going to hear this phrase over and over again, is lower the rate and broaden the base. And what that does, according to them, is it increases the economy, because you're going to lower everybody's tax rate, but you're going to broaden the number of people who pay taxes. And what that's going to do is going to grow the economy, which will ostensibly provide more money for schools, because they'll be able to pay for other things without raiding the school fund for that. They'll be able to pay for transportation out of the general fund. They won't subsidize transportation out of the education fund, which they've had to do for years and years and years and years. So they're trying to shift all these different tax burdens around to get more money for Utah schools. Will they be able to get there? There seems to be a lot of momentum for this tax reform. What's it going to look like? That's anybody's guess.
Okay. Brian Schott, Managing Editor, UtahPolicy.com. We appreciate your weekly reports during the session, and we'll hope to check back with you next year. Well, the Snyderville Planning Commission meets tomorrow night, 6 o'clock at the Sheldon Richens Building, on the phone with an update of some of the items to be discussed. Planner Amir Kaz. Good morning, Amir.
Good morning.
So the house off of Knob Hill Road, this is located kind of above East Canyon Creek. They're overlooking the Snyderville Basin. Commissioners will discuss a low-impact permit for a single-family home that's outside of a platted subdivision. Why is that? I mean, why is it outside of the platted subdivision, I guess?
So the code just requires that a low-impact permit is required for any house that's being built outside of a platted subdivision. Usually with platted subdivisions, setbacks, heights, plat notes, CCNRs, those are a little bit more predictable. So that's one of the reasons why we require it. The other reason is obviously the house is located in the design overlay zone, so it's a double approval.
Okay.
Double decision, I should mention.
Yeah, so the fact that it's a low-impact permit, it means that it doesn't have to come to the Planning Commission, but it is? How come?
So typically, we don't require low-impact permits to come before the Planning Commission. However, it is allowed by the code should we feel that it is necessary due to public interest because of the ridgeline items. We felt that we would take it before the Planning Commission. So in this case, we held a work session to make sure that, you know, that the Planning Commission is comfortable, you know, that the house is located in the most sensitive manner for both access and structure location. We then held a public hearing on January 10th, February 14th, we held a public hearing. That public hearing was closed. The Planning Commission just wished to get some additional information on an alternative driveway. This is in response to a neighbor claiming that the driveway would allow homes to be located with less disturbance than claimed by the applicant. Staff went back to study this alternative design, and it resulted in an 82% increase in disturbance in comparison to the location recommended by staff.
Okay, so the staff is still recommending that we have a house that kind of projects into the horizon as opposed to this long driveway with some noticeable hillside cuts.
Yeah, the hillside would definitely be scarred up versus this location that, you know, you're clustering it to all the existing homes that are over there. You know, so way less scarring, and the visibility, the breaking of the ridge, obviously the house will be visible from other locations, but, you know, as defined by the code, breaking of the ridge from a designated corridor, it would happen for about 20 seconds at freeway speeds. You know, so you're only seeing a couple thousand feet of visibility of breaking ridge. So, you know, that we see that as locating the house in the most sensitive manner, because those deep cuts, fills, retaining walls, they would have much more negative impact on the community than an 11-foot tall house on top of the hill.
All right. Planning Commission could make a decision on that tomorrow. Any idea how many other lots of records we have on hillsides in Snyderville, which would leave us with a similar problem?
There are a number, and this isn't one of those cases where, oh, yeah, it's a lot of record and we're going to grant it. You know, this is really, you know, us looking at, yeah, is this the most sensitive manner possible, you know? So in this situation, this is nothing new. You know, we've given these low-impact permits before. In fact, two immediate next-door neighbors received low-impact permits for construction in the ridgeline overlay zone. The neighbor to the north received a low-impact permit in 2010, I believe, for a series of additions to their home. And the neighbor to the west received the permits in 2015, I believe, for a barn that is located within the ridgeline overlay zone.
Okay. And then finally, just wanted to make note that the Canyons Resort Spa Development Agreement is back on tomorrow's agenda. Just some small tweaks there.
Yeah, that's what we're expecting, yes.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Amir, thanks. That's Snyderville-based Summit County Planner Amir Kaz. Coming up on Wednesday, Park City Municipal holding its annual open house. This is for residents to come learn more about some of the capital projects that are being planned for this spring, summer, and fall. In the studio with details, I have Rhoda Stauffer and Lynn Peake. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So when and where is this going to be?
So it will be in the third floor of the Park City Library building, the community room, on Wednesday from 5 to 6:30 p.m.
Okay, and who's going to be there?
Well, we have... Well, probably about 8 or 9 different presentations. So what we'll do is set up throughout the whole room with boards and all kinds of visuals. And, you know, this is something we do twice a year. And I think it's just a really great visual way to get an idea of our comprehensive community engagement. And also just to give you background and visual representation. So really you can keep up on what the projects are. You know, if you hear about them first here on KPCW or in the paper, it's a little hard to get the visuals. So come to the open house and spend 10 minutes, spend an hour and a half, and just get the background.
So certainly what residents tend to care most about are those projects that either disrupt their lives or their pocketbooks. So what's on tap then to be the most disruptive this summer? I know we got a couple of big road projects.
Yeah, a couple of big road projects. The first one is on Lowell Avenue, and it will start on the uphill side of the main parking lot by PCMR, so that's Manor Avenue, and it'll go all the way up up Lowell to the curve at Empire. So that is a whole road reconstruction, replacing an old sewer line, upgrading the water line, water meters to properties, and improved drainage. They'll redo the roadway pavement, gutter, and stripe. And that project was held over from last year. It'll start mid-April, and it'll go through October. So that one will bring some impacts to those residents.
Okay, and then probably even a bigger one than that is the Prospector Avenue one from Sidewinder all the way
That's
to Bonanza.
Right. So, yeah, like you said, Sidewinder. Well, actually, it's starting at Bonanza going down Prospector, and we're not sure at this point if it'll go around on Gold Dust Lane all the way to Sidewinder. But this is all about a complete street concept where it makes it safe for everyone to be on the street. You know, currently that street is pretty wide, some high speeds, and parking along the side, so not as safe for pedestrians or bikes. So that one is going to be a whole reconstruction, a re-engineering of the roadway, the drainage, the pavement. They're upgrading street lighting with LED fixtures, bus pullouts, and better lane marking so that it will achieve that complete street idea.
So is the idea going to be to close the road down to get it done faster, or are we going to have one way, you know, with traffic controllers all summer long?
You know, I'm not exactly sure how they'll do that, but I would imagine keeping as much of the street open as possible.
All right. What about the impacts this fall then when we start perhaps on the Brewpub parking lot? Is that one of the projects that will be discussed Wednesday?
Yes, that will be. We'll have some current design plans at the open house for the Brewpub Plaza. So this is parking on the bottom and then a plaza on top, bringing that up to street level, bringing more vibrancy is kind of the idea to Upper Main Street. So at the open house, they'll have the design plans right now, and it's the plans are evolving still, but green space, restrooms, a play area for kids, a covered pavilion, and a water feature. And now this will be, construction could begin this fall or next spring. That's still sort of in the decision-making process there. And
once that happens, though, the parking goes away.
Right, for the meantime, during the construction. But we'll come back with 38 spaces in the parking garage.
Okay. Water projects also being planned tend to be the most expensive. What have we got on tap for that?
Well, there's the Creekside Water Treatment Plant, and that has just gotten its final approvals. And that, of course, is over by the fire station on Holiday Ranch Loop. They will do away with the current building next to the Creekside Park. They'll build the new building. It actually includes also a kind of a covered patio space that will complement the park. That is slated to start any time now. And then the next one is at the Quinn's Water Treatment Plant. They're doing new filtration systems. They found that during heavy rain events, the filtration wasn't up to par, really. So that's going to be an ongoing project there.
Okay. And then, Rhoda, what about on the housing front?
We're going to have a table and talk about what we define as affordable housing. So I'll be talking about income levels, how the restrictions will be put in place, how the application process will be done for the 1450-1460 Park Avenue project, which is going to be the first one that will be holding either a lottery or a tiered system and it's going to be focused on full-time employees in the school district boundaries. So, and it will be targeted to households earning 60% of AMI, which is right now for a family of three about $53,000. So So anyway, I will have more information about the application process, the pricing on the units, and how we're going to establish the selection process for 1450, 1460. We will also talk a little bit about the future. There are a couple of other projects lined up for next year, but it's much more about the selection process for when these units are finished.
Okay. The units coming behind that would be the Woodside Park?
Yes.
Units?
Woodside Park is lining up for next year. And Woodside Park is two-phase project. And so there will be boards there and so that people can see the design of phase one, which is where the old fire station is right now. That's going to be 8 units, of which 2 are historic units, again, very similar to 1450, 1460, except that 5 of the units at the Fireside project will have accessory apartments, so some low-cost rentals incorporated into that project. And then phase 2 across Woodside is a larger number of units, and again, the what do you call it, the primary or the highest-ranking choice for design on that side will also be presented and show. It's going to be townhomes again, as well as potentially stacked flat units up on the Empire side.
Okay. Again, it's happening Wednesday, third floor of the library, 5 to 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then your new job, Lynn, of course, is the liaison between all these construction projects and the public. That means that you're the go-to person if people got some complaints.
Sure, absolutely. 615-5206 is my number. And also just wanted to mention the sidewalk project on Main Street. That's that final stretch of sidewalks after taking a break last year. So that's coming on in April, also to wrap up the last of the granite pavers on the sidewalk.
That's going to be in front of what?
So it'll start at 4th Street across from Java Cow, so next to Burns, and all the way up to Grappa. We're going to start in April right in front of the eating establishment to get that dining deck, get it done so that the dining deck can come in the next month in May.
Okay. Lynn, Rona, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
844 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher in the studio with us now from U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association, Tom Kelly. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie. Springtime in Park City, huh?
Yeah. Lots to get through here. So let's start with the Women's World Cup. They were in Squaw Valley.
Yeah, amazing weekend in Squaw Valley. I hope folks were able to tune in on NBCSN to watch Michaela Schifrin win back-to-back races, giant slalom and a slalom, on Friday in the GS, arguably one of the very best, toughest, most challenging giant slalom courses the women have ever run. Chewed up a good percentage of the field. But Michaela Schifrin coming through for a narrow victory there. The 4th career giant slalom win for her, 3rd of this season. And interestingly enough, it put her into contention now, into the GS standings. She's now 80 points behind Tessa Worley, who was 3rd from France. So they'll battle it out coming up this next Sunday in the giant slalom. And then in the slalom the next day, again, rugged course on Red Dog. Michaela coming through with the win there. That wraps up the slalom title for her, and she'll get that Crystal Globe next Saturday at the World Cup Finals in Aspen. The overall still is technically not mathematically determined. Michaela has a 378-point lead over Ilka Stuic of Slovenia. Now, there's really no practical scenario where Michaela would not win the title, but mathematically it is not clinched yet and unlikely to be clinched until Michaela races in the slalom coming up next Saturday. So World Cup Finals in Aspen, it starts Wednesday. Lindsey Vonn will be in action on Wednesday and Thursday in the downhill and the Super-G team event on Friday, and then we switch into GS and slalom racing on the weekend. Top 25 in the world in each discipline will be competing in Aspen. You can watch it all on the live stream at NBCSports.com and also same day and live coverage on NBCSN.
Okay, and we saw some interesting racing. Again, we had, what, Killington opening it up, then to the other coast and on Squaw, and now kind of in the middle of the country at Aspen.
Yeah, we were really pleased this year because of the World Cup Finals. We had some opportunities to go to some new sites. Killington last fall, as you recall, we had around 30,000 spectators there over a couple of days of racing. And then in Squaw Valley, we had over 20,000 over 2 days of racing. These are really, really amazing numbers for the Women's World Cup Tour and certainly among the best anywhere in the world. So just a great weekend at both of those sites. We don't know the makeup of the calendar for next year. year. That will be determined in May at FIST meetings in Slovenia. But both of those sites doing an amazing job, and we know that Aspen's going to put on a remarkable finals this week.
Okay. And then the Junior Alpine Worlds taking place in RE Sweden. Sam Morris here, the story, because that, I guess his win there got him a start at the, at least on the training run for Aspen.
Yeah. You know, Sam Morse, who's a native of Maine but lives out here in Park City and trains, he and Alice Merriweather opened up the Junior World Championships earlier last week in Åre, Sweden, with gold medals in the downhill. It was actually in the men's side, second straight year for the U.S. taking gold there. Eric Arvidsson winning that a year ago. Sam also went on to have strong results, top five in the Super G, and just a great overall time. But as Junior World Champions, they earn a trip to the World Cup Finals, so both Sam Morse and Alice Merriweather will be in the training runs today, and they will both be expected to race in the downhill coming up this Wednesday. It'll be the first World Cup for both of them, and I know a lot of folks in town know Sam from around town, and he's just an amazing young man, and couldn't be more excited for him to have this opportunity.
All right, Freestyle World Championships headed in, were taking place in Spain. What's there?
You know, it's been a little bit of a challenging year results-wise for the freestyle team. Just not the kind of the powerhouse results that they'd been looking for. But boy, it all came together at World Championships. In the dual moguls event, Brad Wilson, who lives here in Park City, picking up the silver medal and the bronze going to Jalen Kauf, who also has a World Cup win this year. But the big news came in the aerials competition to wrap up the freestyle portion of World Championships on Friday with Ashley Caldwell and Jonathan Lillis soaring to gold medals, sweeping the gold. Much like the U.S. did in the 98 Olympics with Eric Burgest and Nikki Stone. What's most notable about Ashley Caldwell is that she did a trick that had never, ever been done before. She had only thrown this trick three times, never in competition. No other woman has ever done this trick. And basically, it was a triple flip with four twists, the double twists coming on the middle flip. It's a trick that the men do, but the women just don't do it. And Ashley's the only woman in the world that's throwing triple flips right now. No one else is willing to challenge her. Now, the downside of that is if you're throwing triples, you have a high degree of difficulty. So if you land it, you're going to score big. But oftentimes you don't. And that's been the case this year. But hats off to Ashley Caldwell for getting up in the start and on her final gold medal jump, throwing something that had never been done before and winning gold. That's the way you win a world championship.
Okay. We also have the snowboard World Championships taking place there as well.
Yeah, Lindsay Jacobellis over in Sierra Nevada, Spain as well, picking up her fifth career gold medal in the snowboard cross event. She's just been totally dominant in that since she began her career well over a decade ago, and kudos to her. That event continues on with more snowboarding and mostly free skiing. Joss Christensen and McCray Williams and others from Park City competing coming up this weekend.
Okay, and then finally, the cross-country World Cup finals in Quebec City.
Really excited to have the World Cup finals coming back to North America for the second time in 2 years. This is an impact of the Russian doping scandal. The International Ski Federation in January moved the scheduled World Cup finals out of Russia and put them in Quebec City. They looked at three different sites around the world and ultimately decided that the tour had such an amazing racing program there a year ago that they would go back to Quebec City. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all of the best cross-country ski racers in the world are in Quebec City for the World Cup Finals. It kicks off with freestyle sprints and then goes to classic distance racing on Saturday and then wraps it up with a freestyle pursuit on Sunday. But looking forward in particular to that freestyle sprint on Friday. It's a great opportunity for Jesse Diggins and Keegan Randall, world championship medalists in that discipline, to show their stuff.
Okay. Well, I'll see you this weekend in Aspen then for the finals.
Yep. See you in Aspen. And folks, tune in this week from Aspen. And if you don't have anything else going on, join Leslie and I and come on over to Aspen and watch it in person.
Okay. Tom Kelly, talk to you next week. KPCW News Time now. KPCW News Time now, 8:51. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Joining us now in the studio with our Park City Education Foundation update, I have the Associate Director of Communications and Development, Jen Bello. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with EVA, as it's known. This is the Elementary Visual Arts. What's going on with that program?
Yes, that this is the fourth year of the program. It started as a school grant at McPullen. It was hard to get volunteers constantly to teach the masterpieces in art. So some years it was good, some years it wasn't, depended on the volunteers. So McPullen asked us for a grant to fund a part-time art teacher about 6 years ago. And since then, it grew into this EVA program that we do in collaboration with the Kimball. And so the kids get monthly art lessons taught by a professional art teacher. The Kimball puts together the curriculum. We pay about $90,000 between the three art teacher salaries and supplies. And it's just a great class. The kids love it. You know, it's something a little different, and it isn't just, you know, painting or drawing. They've done clay. They do pop art. It's a combination kind of between the classic artists and more modern. This month in March, they focused on Dr. Seuss with Read Across America. So it just gives kids a little bit of a different way to look at learning and problem solving and teaching them about our culture and history. So it's been a huge success. The district asks us for that grant every single year. And so we love it.
All right. So it started at McPullen, but it has expanded to all of the schools?
It's at three of the four. Mm-hmm. So Jeremy Ranch has this amazing Masterpieces in Art program. The two women who run it have done it forever. They're really, really good. And their program there is just, it kicks butt. And so they're happy with that. I don't know if someday that might change. But at the other three schools, this is a regular program.
Okay. And again, it's more than just listening. It's hands-on.
It's hands-on, mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's, I think, as we hear more and more about, you know, learning and not just sitting and listening to a lecture, but the hands-on stuff. And that's why the kids love this class. Maybe kids who don't excel in math or language arts, this is a place where they can excel as well. And we're hearing really cool stories. So people are emailing us and saying, oh, you know, we were traveling. We went to a museum and my kid brought their sketchbook and knew who Van Gogh was and, you know, knew who this artist was. And they did a Frank Lloyd Wright lesson in the fall. And the girl drew her kind of stained glass window idea. And she sent it to her grandmother, who does work in stained glass. And she made her piece into a stained glass piece. So the kids are seeing this beyond the classroom, which is really cool.
And I love the kind of the program's motto, in art, we never make mistakes.
Exactly. So that's the thing. There are no mistakes. It's your creativity. It whatever you do is perfect. So that's kind of a nice thing when you don't have a mistake.
All right. Let's see. Coding, the coding program, you're going to start doing some site visits. Again, this is something that was started district-wide. I think it was with the first graders at one point. And now it's expanded to how many grades?
Yes, K through 3. So last year was a pilot in all the first grade classes. It was a great success. And this is, again, kind of like a specialist. So the kids maybe get a coding lesson every other week. And so we're expanding it K through 3. Next year, hopefully K through 4, we are paying for it. And the kid at this age, it isn't writing HTML code, right? It's block-based programming, so it's almost like a game. And it's another thing that's hands-on. You work in groups. It's not just sitting and listening. You actually have to do the program. And they don't make mistakes in coding either. You go back and you debug. So it's a good lesson there.
All right. So and again, it's all of these kids K through 3. It's not something that kids do independently.
No, it's all the kids K through 3. So and they have a class. So in your regular, if you're in, you know, Miss Youngberg's kindergarten class, you know, that class will get a coding lesson. And there are site visits coming up. That was one of the main things I wanted to say today. There's one this morning at let me look at my schedule here at Jeremy Ranch from 9 to 10. But tomorrow is one at Parley's Park and also at McPullen. And even if you don't have a kid in coding, you might want to check it out because it really is quite something to see these kids working together and solving these problems. And you can go on our Facebook page. They're set up as an event and sign up there.
Okay. So what is it that you're paying for? I mean, the software that was needed, but once you buy that, isn't it kind of
right?
What are the other ongoing costs?
So the teacher salaries. So that's the main cost. So all the coding teachers, they're half-time tech coaches because and those have been in place for a while. And then we pay the other half for the coding specialist. So we cover those costs and we will for the next couple years. And then the hope, of course, is that perhaps the district can take over at that point. And the code. So now what we're really excited about is we have these programming now kindergarten through 12th grade. So there's coding in the elementary school and to be rolled up. We funded Arjusats at Ecker, and then we fund robotics at Treasure and the high school. And just hot off the presses, super cool news. The first time ever a robotics team from the high school has qualified for the world first tech championships in April. So they came in fourth out of super regionals. We've had teams go to Super Regionals several years in a row but never qualify for World Championships. And we're pretty much the sole funder of robotics. So that's very exciting to hear.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's it.
Okay. Jen, see you next month. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Leslie.
That's Jen Bello with the Park City Ed Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.